It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about what some statements from Governor Doug Ducey's State of the State address indicate about his plans for K-12 education in Arizona. Matthew Ladner and Andrew Morrill will be my guests. Plus, how big a problem is drug use among young people in Arizona? And an ASU professor is working on research to curb cocaine addiction. Also, longtime journalist Tim McGuire has written a memoir about his physical disabilities and raising a child with Down syndrome. We'll discuss his experiences. We start today's program with the 2015 legislative session. We're just a couple of days in, and a couple of higher-profile bills, or at least a couple that were getting media attention, have faded into the background. With me for a few minutes is Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
So we heard a lot about the Jay Lawrence non-citizen driver's license bill. We also heard a lot about the daylight savings time bill. So those are gone away officially, or could they come back?
It looks like they're not going to happen. The daylight savings bill had actually been introduced, but its sponsor, Peoria Republican Phil Lovis, basically announced that he wasn't going to pursue the bill. He was going to ask for it to basically be put into a desk drawer and killed. And I'm sure that leadership, his leaders, will do that for him. So that bill won't come up in any kind of an official hearing. The other bill, with regards to special notification on driver's licenses for dreamers. That bill was never actually introduced as legislation. It was something that was being talked about as potential legislation, and the person who was exploring the idea, freshman Republican Representative Jay Lawrence, has said that he will not introduce it as legislation. Because he's learned from the department or the Motor Vehicle Division and the Department of Transportation that they're already within the system. There's already a notation that prevents folks with driver's licenses who are not citizens from registering to vote, which is what he said his whole point was.
So, Jim, if Senate President Andy Biggs is on target, and freedom for being skeptical, I don't expect him to be on target, but if he is on target, that's only a 65-day session. A lot of work's going to have to get done pretty quickly here, right?
I don't think he's on target. But that being said, I think there's a lot of people who would be happy if he was on target, if it was a 65-day session. And I think that that's more of a goal, an aspirational goal, than it is a concrete plan. The reality is that even the deadlines that the House and Senate have set, and the deadlines that Senator Biggs agreed to, and some of which are set by rule, don't allow for a 65-day session. Things would have to go right on about 1,000 different fronts for that to happen. But regardless of how long the session is, whether it's 65 days, whether it's 165 days, there is a lot of work to do. You're absolutely right. I mean, there is a very daunting budget crisis that these legislators are staring down right now, and that new Governor Ducey is staring down. And I think that's really the first order of business for everyone to get done.
And, Jim, obviously that's the most important thing, and that's why lawmakers are down at the Capitol. But are there maybe two items you expect to see that might get pushed through, things that perhaps have been there before that didn't make it through, that were vetoed, or other issues we should keep a close eye on?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a couple of really interesting skirmishes down at the Capitol this year. I think three of them really jump to mind. Two of them were around last year. The first of those is ride-sharing and ride-sharing taxis, Uber and Lyft versus the taxi industry. That bill that didn't happen last year. Governor Brewer vetoed a bill last year that would have carved out some regulatory space for companies like Uber and Lyft. Doug Ducey, during his campaign, said that he was amenable to basically government getting out of the way of those kinds of companies. So that bill is going to be back. That fight will be back. It may well have a different outcome at the end of the day if a bill can get through the legislature. The other one that was discussed last year and that never ultimately went anywhere was Tesla. Was the idea of automobile manufacturers selling their products directly to consumers. Right now, state law requires automobiles can't be sold from manufacturer to consumer. They have to go through a dealership. Tesla, the electric car company, doesn't have dealerships. It sells directly to consumers. In Arizona, technically, you can't buy one here. You have to actually buy it from somewhere else and bring it here. So that is a fight. Last year, that fight was kind of against the backdrop of whether Tesla would pick Arizona to build its very large battery factory. That factory has since been awarded to the Reno, Nevada area. But that doesn't change the fact that a lot of people still see a need to open up the dealership only law to allow companies like Tesla to come in. On the flip side, you have the dealerships who see this as a potential erosion of their very business model, and so they are going to fight. They're going to go to the mat for this, without a doubt. The third issue, I think, is going to be one about craft beer. There's already been a lot of talk about this, and there's people are already kind of forming battle lines over whether the regulations on the craft brewing industry, whether there's some of them that maybe should be lifted that maybe punish local brewers who become successful and grow, and it involves basically their retail outlets, their restaurants, their tap rooms, their things like that. Where right now, if a brewery is small enough, they can have those operations and keep them. But if they grow too large, technically they're supposed to give them up. And you've got companies like Four Peaks who are basically in a situation where they have several restaurants that, if they continue to brew more beer and if their growth continues, that they're going to be forced to decide whether they want to brew more beer and make more money that way, or close down restaurants and put employees out of business.
And Jim, for people who follow your Twitter feed at Jim Small, they know you're a fan of craft brew.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is an interesting one. You know, it's been a burgeoning industry nationwide and in Arizona, especially the last few years. So I think that there are a lot of folks who are learning an awful lot about the craft brewing industry who, you know, I think otherwise wouldn't know much about it.
Jim Small, editor of the Capital Times, Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. On Monday, Governor Doug Ducey gave his first State of the State address. K-12 education was on the laundry list of items he talked about, including calling on the legislature to settle a lawsuit related to underfunding the state's schools. Ducey also brought up what he called a classroom's first initiative. So do Ducey's K-12 priorities make sense, and will they improve the education system in Arizona? With me to talk about that and other education issues are Matthew Ladner, Senior Advisor of Policy and Research for the Foundation of Excellence in Education, and Andrew Morrill, President of the Arizona Education Association. Welcome back to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So, Andrew, first reaction to the lawsuit situation, the fact that Doug Ducey was so adamant about that, but also calling on people in education to help us settle this and not get so serious about everything.
Well, right. My first reaction is channeling Thomas Todd, the civil rights champion. A little chaos, controversy, contradiction, and confusion in the governor's comments. But to that point, it is, after all, the plaintiffs, the education groups that have been coming to the table again and again with compromises and settlement offers and being stonewalled by the legislative leadership. So I think we have been reasonable.
Well, I thought it was interesting, too. There was applause, and I presume the applause came from the Democrats in the chamber when he said that.
Possibly. I mean, he said a couple of things. He then looked at the attorney general and asked him to settle something that the courts adjudicated and settled last year or several years ago. Mm-hmm. So it was a little confusing.
Matt, what do you think about that premise, just the idea that Doug Ducey was taking an official stand on that, whether it was a stand that maybe he should have taken before, whatnot, or the impact it could have in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way I read the governor's comments were that, you know, at any given level of funding, and we have profound, deeply felt differences about what that level of funding should be, but at any given level of funding, we should also be focused on getting the biggest bang for the buck we possibly can. So the courtroom drama will play itself out. There will be additional funding in the future. There always has been in the past, but at any given level of funding, we still have a duty to make the most efficient use of each dollar.
Do you think Doug Ducey is a supporter of traditional public schools? Do you think he should be in the position he's in?
I do. I mean, I think that people get mixed up on this, right? So the Arizona Constitution guarantees public education funding, right? Strongly supported by the public. It's a permanent feature of American life, okay? Now, the way we organize public education, that's very much up for discussion. And that's kind of a long, drawn-out process that we have going on in this country and in this state. And I think we need to be moving towards models that will again, do the most that we can with whatever level of funding we provide.
Andrew, considering what Doug Ducey said in his State of the State about charter schools, about there being empty buildings, do you think he's a supporter of traditional public schools?
I'm not sure yet, and it's really unfortunate not to know, because the overwhelming choice in this choice-rich state by 85% of parents annually is to send their students to their neighborhood district public schools, but we can't find the words in the governor's comments to date to acknowledge that choice, and that was just one of the contradictions in his opening address. But yeah, it's really sad, because when you have that kind of a number, then you would think that amount of support, proportionate support, outline for effective strategies in the wake of a crushing teacher shortage and people leaving a profession they love and have trained for. We've heard nothing about support for public school teachers. We heard no new regulations, but a high-stakes civics test. We heard, I want to create a state of opportunity for all, but I want to do it primarily through a charter school model that excludes as many students as it includes. And I want to be the support choice governor. I want to support choice as a policy. But again, where's the support for the overwhelming choice of parents?
Yeah, Matt, where do we go from there?
Well, I think the governor was actually very clear that he wants to drive more of our resources into the classroom. And I would hope that this would be an area that Andrew could actually see eye to eye with the governor.
Well,
on.
He wants to drive the funding into some classrooms. What I've started doing is every time we talk about parent choice, just substitute the word parent, because that's what we're getting. I want to drive funding into classrooms of my choice.
Andrew, this goes
not
far beyond the choice issue.
No,
if
really,
you look at the
really
auditor
doesn't.
General, you look at the auditor's report on district finances, they make this point very clear that during the Napolitano years, when funding per pupil was going up, the percentage of funding making it into the classroom was going down.
An all but meaningless statistic in light of the budget
cuts
that have fallen to the districts.
It continued to go down.
It's almost meaningless.
Whether funding goes up or down in this state, the percentage making it into the classroom has gone down.
Let's clarify that, though.
Yeah, let's do that, because this Auditor General's report that pretends to give an objective view of classroom spending leaves out a lot of things. It leaves out professional development. It leaves out the cost of counselors. It leaves out many things. But even if you assume that it's a apples-to-apples comparison, when you cut funding as we did in Arizona, and yet you introduce policy after policy after policy and call it reform, what happens is you drive up non-classroom funding areas, including administration, and yet Arizona has some of the lowest administrative costs in its K-12 system of any state in the country. This is a ruse.
So when you hear people say there is fat, do you think there is not?
No, the fat's been trimmed, but the muscle's being trimmed, and we're cutting into the bone.
But do you think it's a red herring?
Yes.
Okay. Matt?
I don't agree. I think that there are obvious efficiencies to be gained. For instance, the governor pointed out there are 100 vacant school buildings right now in districts that, you know, they still have funds being spent to keep them around and whatnot. If you go and look at Google Tucson vacant schools, and you'll find news stories about neighborhoods that want to bulldoze their schools because they're a center for vagrants and graffiti and broken windows. And all of that costs money, and it's money you're not spending on educating kids.
It's largely because the budget cuts from 2008 to 2013 forced districts all over the state into the unhappy situation of closing buildings. It's a little disingenuous to then go ahead and point back to those same buildings and say there's an example of waste.
Matt, quick thought before the break.
There's no point in keeping them on the books. You need to sell them, get rid of them, do something with them. Don't leave them vacant.
We'll continue our conversation about K-12 education in Arizona with Andrew Morrill and Matthew Ladner right after this break on Here and Now.
KJZZ is supported by the Maricopa County Home and Garden Show this Friday through Sunday at the State Fairgrounds. Hundreds of local home improvement and gardening exhibits, walk-through displays, and seminars all weekend long. Info at mchomeshows.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now. Partly cloudy skies and 48 degrees in Tucson. It's cloudy and 38 in Prescott. Cloudy and 50 in Casa Grande. Mostly cloudy skies in Flagstaff, where they have 34 degrees. Fair skies and 61 degrees right now in Yuma. Well, KJZZ thanks Andrea for donating her Pontiac Grand Am to support her favorite shows. You can donate your vehicle, too, by visiting cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. Mostly sunny skies in the valley right now, and it's 56 degrees at KJZZ at 1121.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Matthew Ladner and Andrew Morrill about K-12 education in Arizona, especially coming out of Governor Doug Ducey's first State of the State address earlier this week. Let's talk about civics, Andrew. You brought that up earlier. Certainly people believe, I think, in general, that we should know our history, that children should know our history, and students as well. But when it's K-12 couched in civics and knowing who Sandra Day O'Connor and John Adams are and this sort of thing, as Doug Ducey did. Where does that rest as a priority for you?
Well, a standalone high-stakes test, when the state is moving away from high-stakes tests and parents are decrying them all over the country and in Arizona, is a curious approach. I taught high school English for 17 years. The way I taught democracy was to get my students into debate situations, throw them an issue, let them prepare, research the issues in perspective, square off against each other, have to listen to each other, like Matt and I are doing right now. And I have to say, I like Matt Ladner very much. I really do. We argue all the time. But there's how you learn the deeper principles of democracy, not with rote memorization, particularly when a lot of this is already covered in our curriculum.
Matt?
Well, look, bottom line, I think that if you remember the old Jay Leno skits of the man on the street, you know, and they say, hey, it's Independence Day today. Independence from who? And you see people say Germany, right? I don't think it was terribly difficult to do those. This is one of the fundamental purposes of public education in the first place. And, you know, yes, it's in the curriculum, but obviously nationally we got a problem. We used to be, and we have this verified by things like NAEP. The knowledge of these things is very lacking, and something needs to be done about it.
Then it doesn't go far enough. I mean, good grief. I get the wrong change from store clerks all the time. I think we should have a high-stakes test for the 12 times 12 multiplication tables, and we should do that. Now, that's taught in math, but certain people make mistakes. I also think driving is very important. Let's, by all means, make a high-stakes test out of the driver's license test. Since, after all, you can get a driver's license at 16, it stands to reason you should be able to do that for your diploma.
I'm glad you're here. Do you think that way,
absolutely.
Andrew?
Absolutely. Let's take every content area we already have and create another high-stakes test.
That's amazing. I
sure.
love it. Matt, AEA is in favor of
we might even actually
learning.
Have time for instruction of students.
How about that?
Matt, one thing that always comes up for me is this concept of how much responsibility falls on teachers in the schools. And I don't know if this is scientifically proven, but it sure seems like when it's a situation where parents take the time to read with their kids or talk with their kids about homework, it makes a much bigger difference. Now, I don't know if that falls, if there's a stereotype of whether in low-income families it happens less often, if people have to work multiple jobs and that kind of thing. But how much pressure are we putting on teachers to teach these things when they should teach it, but we hope that there's a little bit more of a backup at home to sort of reinforce it?
There's no doubt that parental involvement is very, very important. There's no doubt about that. Now, having said that, what we want are schools that actually will drive parental involvement, right? That don't view it as some sort of exogenous thing that is outside their control, but rather, you know, take concrete steps to involve and to basically nudge parents every single way you can to get that involvement. So we've seen examples of schools with profoundly disadvantaged kids that make remarkable gains in their academic learning. And that's kind of what it takes.
But in the meantime, we're going to put the burden on teachers. Look, the fact is that to say that this shouldn't bring any costs to a district is to basically admit that you don't really know how an education system works. If this is a high-stakes test, and it's a standardized test, it means that in its DNA, people are going to fail because all standardized tests sort people out by performance. There has been no plan as to what to do to remediate and intervene for those students that do fail this test.
I don't want to start some artificial fight here, but Andrew, is there...
No, this is a real one. We like the real ones.
Is there an issue where we're seeing that low-income neighborhoods, low-income schools are being discriminated against, in a sense, when it comes to funding? Are there certain disadvantages built into the system, or is that an unfair stereotype that maybe a lot of people have?
I'm not sure, but I can tell you this. There is a really troubling trend. About the same time that efforts to aggressively underfund education started, with the excuse of a recession, but really well before that, we also noticed that for the first era, the first time in American history, whites would no longer be the majority population in our public schools. And it is troubling to me as a former classroom teacher that is an uncomfortable reality, that right now there is this trek that says, well, maybe this is the time to back away the funding and create these franchises of charters and other choices. But what drives a lot of the quote-unquote reformers crazy is that still in all, you have 85% of parents choosing every year to send their students to their neighborhood district schools. Let's support that choice.
Matt, does school choice make a difference? Is that one of the pluses of school choice?
Absolutely. And look, I mean, if you support public education, then you have to be willing to take the steps that is going to be required to make it actually work, right? You take a look at the Arizona Board of Regents report that showed that 18.6% of the Arizona graduating class of 2006 earned a BA degree in 6 years, okay? No matter where you are on the political spectrum, right, I think we can all agree that that's not good enough, right? And we need to be searching for ways to do much better than that, because we need, I mean, this, if you're serious about public education, then you have to search for ways to make it work better.
What's curious about that is that after 20 years of school choice policies in the state, even the folks that propose the reforms would then have to say, charter schools have not moved the needles. Vouchers have not moved the needle. We haven't really found any secret to reform. Turns out there's really no secret as good as standing by the number one choice parents make.
Oh, it's not true at all. Mm. In fact, if you take a look at the same Arizona Board of Regents report, you'll see that the top of the list of schools in this state are dominated by magnet and charter schools.
How can it be that we have that remediation problem when we were sold all along the river that charters were going to improve everything and vouchers were going to improve everything? And by the way, those top-performing charters that the governor cites and you cite have our dropout factories. When you compare the sixth-grade cohort to the graduating class 6 years later, they lose 45 and 50% of their students. We would be screaming to close district schools if they had that kind of dropout rate.
There's not a whole lot of closing of district schools going on in this state.
Well, that's deplorable, of that kind of charter school exodus. And then to claim disingenuously, guess what? 90% of the survivors that weren't exited out went on to college.
Guys, about 90 seconds left, and an issue close to my heart is this sort of STEM versus STEAM, this idea that are we taking arts out of the schools and whatnot. There are charter schools that certainly specialize in certain things like this. Matt, what are your thoughts on that? When we take art out of the schools, is it having as big an impact as some of us may think, this idea that the well-rounded education is mm-hmm. being lost?
Yeah, no, look, there's actually some really exciting new research coming out about the overall education impacts of the arts, and one of my three children goes to the Arizona School for the Arts, and I'm very happy with it. So, I mean, the arts definitely should have a place. The key is to not exclude it as a way to try to, you know, drill more on math and reading, but to rather use it as a way to teach math and reading better.
Andrew, final thoughts on that?
How dare you find a topic that Matt and I agree on completely? It really shows some nerve. A lot of CEOs are talking these days about, you know, they went to school in a strong liberal arts program. So, yes, we definitely want this. The STEAM is more powerful than the STEM, I think.
Andrew Morrill is president of the Arizona Education Association. Matthew Ladner is senior advisor of policy and research for the Foundation of Excellence in Education. We just dipped our toes in the water of this issue, guys. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks you
for having us.
Thanks, Matt.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last night, a number of media outlets in Arizona carried a production by ASU's Cronkite School called Hooked. It explored the growing use of heroin among Arizonans in their 20s. According to an analysis of hospital records done by reporters and producers, more 21 to 25-year-olds have overdosed on heroin in Arizona in recent years than any other age group. But what other drugs are causing concerns in the state, especially among teens? With me for a few minutes to talk about that is Teresa Londono, Program Manager at Drug-Free AZ Kids. Teresa, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
For kids who've used illicit drugs in Arizona, at what age do they typically start?
Well, the average age of first drug use in the state of Arizona is 13 years old. So if one thinks that's the average, kids in as young as elementary school are being exposed to some drugs. And so it's so important for parents to understand that and to be talking early and often with their kids about the dangers of these substances.
And I phrased it as illicit drugs. Does that include alcohol as well?
Yes, that includes alcohol as well.
What, I suppose this is a different answer for many, many people, depending on what category we fall into, but what leads to kids trying drugs? How much does peer pressure play into that?
Well, peer pressure certainly does play a big role. Research has shown that two things influence a young person's decision to try drugs or alcohol, and that is the perception of risk versus the perception of safety. and the perception of social acceptability. So if a drug is perceived to have low risk and high social acceptability, then the risk is higher that a young person would be more likely to try it.
And do you know how many kids, I know it's hard to have a percentage of this, but do you think that kids at such a young age even think about the possibility of becoming addicted?
Well, you know, what we know about the brain development of kids and teens is that, you know, the part of the brain that's responsible for foresight and for anticipating consequences is not fully developed until the age of 25. So, you know, it's no wonder that kids are not thinking through what the risks and what the possible negative consequences could be.
I want to come back to what you had to say about parents talking with their kids. Is there advice that Drug Free Easy Kids has or other places you've looked where you talk to parents about how they can bring up the topic? I imagine most parents don't want to bring this up when their child is 10 years old, but they probably have to.
Yeah, it's really important. On our website, drugfreeazkids.org, there is a host of resources and tools for parents to kind of guide them as to how to bring up those topics, what kids need to know at the different developmental stages. So we've got information there on what parents can be talking to their kids about as young as preschool. You know, prevention can't begin early enough, and every developmental stage along the way through high school.
Is there a growing trend that concerns you the most? We've heard a lot about prescription drug abuse.
Yes, prescription drug abuse. The CDC refers to it as an epidemic among teens. In Arizona, almost 1 in 5 high school seniors has abused prescription medication in their lifetime. So, you know, when you think of a typical classroom of high school seniors, when you think of 1 in 5, how many kids in a typical high school classroom, you know, have already been dabbling in this? So it's very important that parents understand and that parents educate themselves about how they are key to keeping their kids safe from these dangers.
Teresa, as I mentioned, there was a media special last night focused on heroin. There's also concern about meth use. But when we look at actual hard numbers, it does appear that though those are incredibly addictive drugs, those are not what the average person may try or have issues with. Are there other things that don't get talked about quite enough? Many years back, maybe a decade ago, there was a big push for Arizona to adopt the meth project that was started in Montana. But are there other things that need to be talked about at the grassroots level that perhaps don't get quite as much attention?
Yeah, well, you know, that the example you bring up with meth, that is such a good example of how with messaging and education, we were able to change those assumptions and those perceptions of kids. They stopped looking at that as a low-risk thing to try, and they started realizing that this was a very high risk, and thus the numbers of young people trying that have dropped. So if we can do that with prescription drugs, you know, prescription drugs is something that exists in nearly every home. You know, so we need to be thinking not only of safeguarding our own kids, but their friends who come to visit at our houses. We need to be thinking of what medicines are easily available if they go to their grandparents' house or an aunt's and uncle's house or a neighbor's house. It's very important that we're safeguarding those prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs. It's very important that we're communicating with them, explaining to them what those dangers are. We know that kids whose parents speak to them early and often about the dangers of drugs are up to 50% less likely to try drugs and alcohol. Also teaching their kids refusal skills, you know, rehearsing with your child. Well, you know, if one of your friends were to offer you a drink or a pill or a smoke, what would you say? What would you do? Talk that through, rehearse, you know, so that way your child will be more ready when they're in that situation and you're not there with them to help them through it. Also, disposal of prescription and over-the-counter medicines is so important. Safe disposal. A lot of pharmacies have take-back receptacles. If that's not available, another safe way to get rid of prescription medicines is to ground them up if they're in pill form and mix them with something, you know, gross that nobody would want to go through, like coffee grounds or eggshells or cat litter, and wrap it up in plastic and tuck it in the garbage. You don't want to be flushing those things down the drains.
Interesting. Teresa Londono is Program Manager at Drug Free AZ Kids. Teresa, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Clearly, when it comes to illegal substances, addiction is a significant concern, and addiction to cocaine can be especially daunting. Arizona State University School of Life Sciences Professor Janet Neiswander is leading an effort to find safe treatment for cocaine addiction, and she joins me now. Professor, good morning. Professor Neiswander, are you with us? Again, we're talking about the possibility of breaking cocaine addiction here on KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up a little bit later on this hour, we'll talk with one of the owners of the Arizona Coyotes, Anthony LeBlanc. And then a little bit later on as well, we'll talk with ASU professor Tim McGuire about his new memoir about growing up disabled and raising a child with Down syndrome. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein. This is 91.5 KJZZ, and you're listening to Here and Now. Joining us right now is Arizona State University School of Life Sciences Professor Janet Neiswander. Professor, good morning. We'll be back with Professor Neiswander in just a little bit. We'll take a short break here on KJZZ and be right back.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM or KJZZ.org. Valley forecast calling for mostly sunny skies today, a high of 67. That's right at average for today. Clear skies, a low near 47 overnight, and then mostly sunny skies for the next couple of days and on through the weekend with highs in the mid to low 70s. Stay with us at 12 for Here and Now from Boston. Today, as new governors and lawmakers across the country are sworn in this week, nearly a dozen states are facing budget shortfalls. And Texas is known for oil, but its economy is diverse, and that may help soften the blow of falling oil prices. NPR's Here and Now is coming up at noon on KJZZ. Partly sunny skies right now in the valley, and it's 56 degrees at 11:39.
KJZZ is supported by ASU College of Public Service and Community Solutions. New name, new speakers series. Why death and grief are needed for life and joy. Tuesday, January 20th. Details at publicservice.asu.edu/talks.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Addiction can be a significant concern, and addiction to cocaine can be especially daunting. ASU School of Life Sciences Professor Janet Neiswander is leading an effort to find safe treatment for cocaine addiction, and she joins us by phone. Professor, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you very much for bearing with us there. How does cocaine affect the brain differently from other drugs?
Well, cocaine works directly on both dopamine and serotonin neurotransmitter systems, and dopamine systems is involved in reward, and so it can produce an intense euphoric effect, even greater than natural rewards. And serotonin is very important for mood and regulation of mood. For example, when serotonin systems are dysregulated, people can become anxious and depressed.
How much of an impact have side effects had then on developing some sort of treatment to addiction to cocaine? And how much does that go into all the research you do, saying, well, this might work, but boy, the side effects are going to be pretty horrible?
Right. That's a good question. With one line of attack is to try to alter the dopamine system. And in doing that, though, drugs that are available have very horrific side effects. In fact, some of the dopaminergic drugs are used as antipsychotics, and they produce an anhedonic state where people have a difficult time experiencing pleasure. They have motor impairments, and so it's really that class of drugs is really quite a nasty class of drugs. And so you have issues with compliance. So our lab is focused on serotonergic drugs, which are more involved in mood. And what we're interested in is, instead of attacking the reinforcing or rewarding effects of the drug, looking at neural mechanisms and ways of countering drug craving, which can lead to relapse in people who are recovering.
Interesting. Is any other drugs type of addiction that, at least that we would have heard of, similar to cocaine?
Well, other psychomotor stimulants, such as amphetamine, is similar to cocaine. And really, I think that even though each drug affects the brain in unique ways, there is probably also a common underlying pathology involved in perhaps even all addictions. So there's both separate and common neural mechanisms involved in various addictive substances.
And Professor, I want to make sure we clarify, too, when it comes to treatment for addiction, because of the way the mind works, is there any way, even with an effective treatment that you may develop, is there any way to actually eliminate the addiction altogether? Or if someone has tried it, will there always be that temptation in the back of their mind, potentially?
Right. At this point in time, I think most effort is being put forth trying to find some pharmacologic treatments that would be adjuncts to other kinds of psychotherapy. As we learn more about the brain, however, and we really understand the neural mechanisms underlying cocaine addiction, it may be possible way down the line to actually cure drug abuse. That would be the ultimate hope. But I think, for the more near future, we're looking for drugs that at least can help with decreasing cocaine craving. And also drugs that would be helpful to break the habit of taking drugs.
Fascinating. Arizona State University School of Life Sciences Professor Janet Nyswander is leading an effort to find safe treatment for cocaine addiction. I hope we can have you back. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Earlier this month, the Arizona Coyotes officially added a new majority owner. Andrew Barraway purchased a 51% stake in the team, which became a reality on December 31st. Barraway was introduced to the Valley's media on January 2nd.
I am so excited to be here and to be a Coyote. I can't even begin to tell you. It feels great to be here. It was a long haul, and I'm thrilled and as happy as can be.
I'm buying this team because I'm a lifelong, sports and hockey fan, and it's always been my dream to become an owner, and I want to bring a winner to the Valley. I'm thrilled to be here and thrilled to be an owner and would not have gone through this really difficult process in buying a team just to go flip it. I don't think people buy teams to go make money. That's not the goal here.
Barraway's stake in the Coyotes reportedly cost $152.5 million, so it appears the team's value is on the way up. With me to talk for a couple of minutes about the Coyotes on and off the ice is the team's president and CEO, Anthony LeBlanc. Anthony, good morning.
Good morning.
So is the team's value going up, and if so, why?
Well, I think you're seeing an increase in valuations across not just the National Hockey League, but in professional sports in general. I think it's fair to say that, when we purchased the Coyotes 18 months ago as Ice Arizona, at the time it was viewed as a risky investment. But we've, not trying to pat ourselves on the back too aggressively, but we've done a decent job of starting to effectuate the change that we felt we could, which obviously leads to an increase in valuation.
Can you tell me a little bit about Andrew Barraway? Was it all about the money, or did you and your partners have to look for compatibility with him as well?
Well, it's interesting because we were not out looking for partners. What happened was Andy and us share similar, actually the same bankers in New York, and they reached out to us in the summer and asked if we'd be interested in having a discussion with them. So I was in New York and sat down with them and just immediately felt that there was a connection, very similar to myself and the original partners in Nice, Arizona, and just a real passionate sports fan. And at the end of the day, just a great guy, which is what you look for when you're partnering with people on these types of investment, are people that you enjoy spending time with. And Andy is one of those guys.
Is the Coyotes organization in strong shape, and are you on a level playing field or ice as far as the rest of the NHL is concerned?
Well, I think on the business side, we've grown in leaps and bounds over the last 18 months, which, you know, quite frankly, isn't a surprise considering the state of the franchise and the circumstances that were surrounding the franchise. On the ice, we're not happy with where we are. We're basically at the midpoint of the season, and as you reflect on the first half, none of us in this organization are happy with what we have seen on the ice, and we think that we're a better team than the results have shown.
That's interesting. Are there any things that explain that? You've had a pretty successful head coach there for quite a while. Is it goalkeeping? Is that the big thing?
I think it's all facets of the game. I mean, I think if you talk to Coach Tippett or you talk to GM Maloney, they'll say they're not happy with the consistency. Goaltending, you know, we've had some great, like last night, for example, we had another very strong performance, and unfortunately, you know, two bad bounces will kind of turn the game the other way. But at the end of the day, what we've noticed is that we're just not playing a consistent style of hockey that you usually see out of a Dave Tippett hockey club.
How is attendance this season? I was actually looking ahead at your schedule thinking, oh, the Super Bowl, Waste Management Open, that might help, but you're going to be on a long road trip through that period, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, the Super Bowl host committee booked our building even before we bought the team 18 months ago for a variety of events that they'll be hosting. So, unfortunately, we won't have any games in and around the Super Bowl. But the good news is that that attendance is up this year. You know, we still have, you know, nights like last night where we were not happy with the attendance in the building, but you know, tomorrow night we have Calgary in town. We'll have a nice crowd. We had a great crowd last weekend when we had Philly in town. But the good news is we had aggressive increases in our attendance and game revenue last year, and this year we continue to improve upon that.
What have you learned about what it takes to have a consistent winner in the NHL over the past 18 months? Because in many sports, the idea is, except unless you're the absolute top of the heap when it comes to revenue, you have to have a mix of homegrown players and then a few free agents sort of picked in there.
Yeah, it really is. It's a case of patience. And even the top revenue teams, I don't think, are the models that you want to follow. What, you know, if you talk to Don Maloney, he'll preach, you know, even though we're not fans of the team, we're fans of what they've done in regards to the Detroit Red Wings. Franchises like Chicago or Pittsburgh, if you look at franchises like that, the ones that have had a lot of success in the NHL in the last 10 years, it starts with their drafting, it's their scouting, and that's an area where we as an organization put a lot of extra resources that weren't there over the last 5 years. Just this past offseason is when we started increasing that budget. So it takes time, it takes patience, and you know, you can't just have a quick knee-jerk reaction when you don't like the way things are going in the standings.
Do you pay attention at all to the Canadian media, which has always sort of put a target on the back of the Coyotes? This is our next claim for it to bring back to Canada.
Well, as a Canadian myself, it's difficult to ignore it. But look, I've learned through this process, and don't get me wrong, there's some great media up in Canada, and there's some media that I don't agree with their opinions. But quite frankly, that's, you know, it's been the case, you know, here even in Arizona. There's been some sources that we've had, you know, extensive disagreements with. At the end of the day, you know, we want to ensure that our fans and our partners are getting the correct information, and for the most part, we think that they are getting that. And all of this hyperbole and speculation about the future of the franchise, you know, it's just silliness. But you know, as I said a couple of times in the last couple of weeks, I can pray for a lot of things that won't come true. So I'll just keep plugging away and ensuring that we get the right message out there.
Anthony LeBlanc is president and CEO of the Arizona Coyotes. Anthony, thank you for squeezing us in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Tim McGuire is an accomplished newspaper writer and editor and a professor at ASU's Walter Cronkite School. He was also born with a physical disability, and he and his wife raised a son with Down syndrome. McGuire writes about all of that in his new book, Some People Even Take Them Home, and he joins me in studio. Tim, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks you for having me.
So you were born with a physical disability. Can you describe what it is?
It's called arthrogryposis multicongenita, and the biggest impact is I had 13 surgeries before I was 16 years old.
It seems like you were able to overcome that. What had that happen? I mean, what we talk about, there's a lot of writing in the book about your parents. At first, they were sort of stunned by your birth. And
very, very stunned, very embarrassed, wanted to hide me. Some of their friends suggested that I be committed to a mental institution. In 1949, if you were born crippled, you were put in a mental institution. You must be retarded. Mm-hmm. And those were the words that were used at that time. And they resisted that, obviously. But as I say in the book, one wonders how many people got put in those kinds of institutions who should not have. But the big thing about my rearing was they were told by our doctor not to spoil me. So yeah. I did everything anybody else would do. And I had one person who was editing the book early on who said, "Your parents were cruel." And so I went back and rewrote and said, no, they were not. They built me into what I was and what I am today. Somebody who does not back down and somebody who can get through just about anything.
I want to make sure I quote this correctly, because in recounting your own early days, you write that even the first night, your parents instinctively knew something all parents of a disabled child know, that despair is the mortal enemy. With your background, did you have a level of despair when your son Jason was born with Down syndrome?
Well, my wife did. Because of my background, I vowed almost from the beginning, I will not ask why me. Somehow I was conditioned never to ask why me. And now I was a little goofy at times. I was convinced I'd be the best Down syndrome dad ever. I'm probably not. I didn't despair. I really didn't. My wife had moments of that, but we always talked things through and knew what would what was our escape plan and how we would deal with things. We decided to take Jason home. That's the title of the book. Mm-hmm. The doctor told us not to, or implied that we should not. We decided to take him home as long as he didn't threaten our marriage and any other children. We had one other at the time, and we later had another. And that worked perfectly. And when Jason started to become an issue at the age of 22, when you were fighting the same battles you had for 20 years, he went into a group home when the other kids left the home, and that made sense to him.
So that was not as big a battle as you would have anticipated?
It was at first. He kept saying, "Oh, you don't have to do that," as if, don't go to the trouble. but he got over that, and when at his workplace, he started to talk to people who were in group homes, and they told him that they go places and do stuff. And that excited him because he was getting bored with his old parents and his busy siblings who were building their own lives.
So how much of the year do you spend in Arizona? Are you here all year round?
No, I'm permanent, although I go north for a couple of months.
Okay.
To see the grandkids.
How often do you see Jason?
I see Jason those 2 months. He was out here a week ago for the holidays for a week. I see him 3 or 4 or 5 times outside of that 2 weeks, the 10 weeks that we get together.
Has the dynamic of your relationship changed over the years, or because?
Certainly it has, because he is far more independent. When he was in the house, we kind of did everything. We made all the judgments. He's now independent. And, for example, after he stayed here for 6 days, he was ready to go home. He wanted his own life back, which is a thrill. It really is a thrill to see that. So he very much enjoys his independent lifestyle.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Tim McGuire, ASU Cronkite School professor. We're talking about his new book called Some People Even Take Them Home. Tim, I want to get back to your life, but I also want to ask another question about Jason, which is, I don't want this to sound trite, because when people have children with Down syndrome, we often hear about they're special, they smile all day, it's the greatest gift one could ever have. Can you balance that out for me? Can you tell me about the challenges with also maybe things you've learned from him?
Sure. That's what the book is really about, that it's not all roses and tulips. Mm-hmm. And I very much emphasize, I mean, we toilet trained him for 3 years. Mm-hmm. Any parent here knows how hard, how awful that would be. And it was terrible for my wife. He used to run. He'd run away. There's a wonderful story in the book how he ran away one time, and my 9-year-old daughter at the time was chasing him, went up to a house that she thought he'd gone into, and said, is there a little boy here? And the woman says, yeah, he's up in my closet. We've never understood why she allowed a hostile occupation of the closet, but... And Jason has been very frustrated with being Down syndrome. Several times when he was 16, the story then, he was 16. My daughter, he had just turned 16. He and my daughter were in McDonald's. And my daughter said, look, Jason, somebody who has Down syndrome, just like you. And he said, I stopped being Down syndrome when I was 16. He said that when he was 18 and 21. There's several scenes. He does not like to have Down syndrome. He knows he's different. He knows there's a lot of things he can't do. He knows he can't love like his sister and brother. He knows all that. And so there is a great frustration. And I do hate that stereotype of... and plus, we discourage some of that. When you see Down syndrome children hug people, that makes them different. My wife was brilliant, and she taught him to high five to make him more like other people. We always strive to help him be normal. That was what I was striving for mm-hmm. throughout my life, was to be accepted as normal until I got comfortable with who I was around the age of 43.
Yeah, you write about checking the disabled box for the first time at that age. What was there some sort of epiphany for you?
Yeah, there was. The form came around. It had come around every year, and somehow I stared at it, and I said, you know, I am disabled, and I need to check that because the fact is my hospital stays, my surgeries, all of that has made me what I am today. And I was able to come to grips with that. And I've had a far more mellow life and comfortable life since I checked that box.
We only have a minute or so left, but you mentioned Jason's frustration. And there are times in the book where you talk about you had to have a fancy luxury car, and then, you know, people would look at you differently. And then even the fact you hit such heights as a newspaper man. Is that frustration still there? And if it is it just because it's part of your regular personality?
Yeah, it's a little bit of my personality. I've got friends who will say that I would be feisty no matter what. But certainly I'm very aware still of being looked at differently. I was in a public place last year, and two people were laughing at me.